I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whose birthday we celebrate on Monday, gave a number of powerful speeches about the right to vote. Here's a clip from his famous 1957 speech, Give Us the Ballot.
Give us the ballot, and we will no longer have to worry the federal government about our basic rights. Give us the ballot, and we will no longer plead to the federal government for passage of an anti-lynching law. We will, by the power of our vote, write the law on the statute books of the South and bring an end to the dastardly acts of the hooded perpetrators of violence. Give us the ballot, and we will transform the salient misdeeds of bloodthirsty mobs into the calculated good deeds of orderly citizens. Give us the ballot, and we will fill our legislative halls with men of goodwill and send to the sacred halls of Congress men who will not sign a Southern manifesto because of their devotion to the manifesto of justice. Give us the ballot.
The Selma to Montgomery protest marches in 1965 were in response to the violence and barriers that African Americans faced trying to vote and to highlight the need for a National Voting Rights Act. Later that year, President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act, considered by many the country's most consequential civil rights law. For instance, between 1965 and 1967, black voter registration in Mississippi went from about 7% to 60%. Well, now we're engaged in another battle over the right to vote in Congress and in the states. We asked for Nita Tolson to put the current political fight into a historical context. She's vice dean at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law, where she is a professor of law. She's got a book coming out next year titled In Congress We Trust, with a question mark, Enforcing Voting Rights from the Founding to the Jim Crow Era. And for Nita Tolson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Very welcome. And I should say to our listeners, she is joining us by Skype. And you can join us as well. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call 1-888-477-9499. Professor Tolson, have we ever been in a time when we were not fighting about the right to vote?
No, we haven't. And to be honest, we'll never be in a time where we're not fighting about the right to vote because democracy is a work in progress. Our history has taught us that. Over the past 100 years or so, African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, every minority group in this country pretty much has had to fight for their right to vote consistently. So even with the Voting Rights Act of 1965, it is a data point. Yes, it is very consequential, and I agree with you, Marty. It is one of the most important pieces of legislation this country has ever passed. But even with that, minority groups have continued to fight for their right to vote. They have consistently litigated pursuant to the Voting Rights Act to challenge state laws that restrict the right to vote, state laws that we're seeing more of in recent years. So the fight continues.
Well, let's go to the beginning. Let's go to the founding fathers, as we call them. Their view of the right to vote was that if you were a white man with property, you had the right to vote.
Absolutely. So in the founding era, it was very common for property ownership or some type of taxpaying requirement to be a prerequisite to casting a ballot. But even in the early years, there was a movement to get rid of property requirements for voting. And by the time we get to the mid-19th century, property requirements are pretty much abolished. It only existed in a couple states. The post-Civil War era and Reconstruction is a time in which you really saw a huge expansion of the right to vote, not only with just African Americans, but also poor whites. And so it really was a period in our history in which it was very inclusive in a sense. And part of the sort of common knowledge is that Reconstruction was only 10 years. But in reality, African-Americans voted in large numbers across many places in the South leading up to the 20th century. So it wasn't just a 10-year period in which African-Americans were casting a ballot. African-Americans fought for their right to vote well into the 20th century.
Well, and picking up on that, there were, of course, you know, the amendments that gave at least black men the right to vote. But then many were faced with poll taxes and literacy tests and threats and violence. I mean, it seems you know, one step forward and maybe two steps back.
And this is why the fight is always ongoing, because even with the Reconstruction Amendment, so the 15th Amendment in particular, prohibited racial discrimination in voting. You had congressional legislation during this time to enforce the 15th Amendment and go after organizations like the Ku Klux Klan that tried to prevent African-Americans from casting ballots. But even with those threats, African-Americans continued to turn out. But in 1890 or so, you started to see southern states, starting with Mississippi and pretty much every other southern state followed suit, change their state constitutions in order to make it more difficult for individuals to vote. But importantly, they changed their state constitution in ways that were facially race neutral. So a lot of the discrimination in voting happened at the local level. You had election administrators who applied the law in a disparate way to disenfranchise African Americans on these race neutral laws. And occasionally they also applied them to white people who would have formed coalitions with black voters. They applied these laws in order to prevent them from voting as well. So our history is one where we've really struggled to fulfill our mandate of democracy. We've embraced democratic norms, but at various points we have prevented groups of people from voting on racial lines, on religious lines, based on political affiliation and belief. And so with that history, it's really hard to escape it. And this is why you always have to be vigilant when it comes to protecting the right to vote, because these threats do crop up.
Well, and it reminds you a little bit today about the sort of, you know, what's happening in Congress versus what's happening in a number of states. And it should be said, these are Republican controlled states that are instituting laws and regulations to frankly make it harder to vote.
Well, this is why I mentioned the state constitutional conventions in the post-1890 era, because a lot of what we're seeing today reminds me of that period. So those state constitutions were amended in ways that were facially race neutral, but targeted African-Americans and other people of color in order to disenfranchise them. You see a similar thing with Texas and Georgia today. For example, the new Georgia law provides for less time to request absentee ballots, and it also imposes a fairly strict voter ID requirement to vote absentee, while expanding early in-person voting in smaller counties. Now, that's facially race neutral, right? It doesn't mention race on its face, but it is targeted towards how people of color and white people voted in the 2020 election. People of color disproportionately voted absentee in Georgia in 2020, and white voters disproportionately voted early in person. So in many ways, the current laws are operating the same way that the laws of the 1890s operated to disenfranchise black people.
Well, let me talk about the Voting Rights Act of 1965. This, of course, was signed by President Johnson. I think feeling what Dr. King and other civil rights protesters were, frankly, marching for. And he heeded their call. Take us back to that time.
So the Voting Rights Act was very, very important, just in terms of, if you think about the decades that went into the decades of investment that black communities put in terms of trying to advocate for the Voting Rights Act. In the late 1950s, you had some pretty watered down civil rights legislation. So there was a Civil Rights Act in 1957, and you also had a Civil Rights Act in 1964. But it wasn't really until the Voting Rights Act was adopted in 1965 that you saw the sea change in the political systems across the South that black people had been advocating for decades. So in the Dr. King clip that you played at the top of our segment, one of the things that he pointed to, and which I love, is this notion that if you give black people the ballot, then we won't have to bother the federal government with our demands, because then we could just use the power of our vote in order to enact the policies that we want to see at both the state and federal level. And I think the Voting Rights Act really does try to honor those parts of Dr. King's speech. So, for example, one provision of the Voting Rights Act that was really, really important was Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, because what it did was it required those jurisdictions that have historically discriminated against people of color, African-Americans, Latinos, and so on, to pre-clear any changes to their voting laws with the federal government before those changes could go into effect. And so what this did was it made it very difficult for these states to adopt discriminatory voting laws. And this is why, Marty, you saw that increase in Mississippi from single digits to 60% in only a very short time.
Yeah, just
because
2 years.
It was a tool that allowed the federal government to step in and say, OK, Mississippi, if you want to change your voting laws, you have to ask for permission from us. Right. And this is why the Voting Rights Act was so effective. And this is also why the federal government was able to put some meat behind what Dr. King was demanding all those years earlier.
Well, let me quote from President Johnson, who said it's a the act is at that time and was a triumph for freedom as huge as any victory that's ever been won on the battlefield. And we should note that it's I saw pictures of Ronald Reagan extending the, you know, the Voting Rights Act in 1982. And now it's hit this roadblock. Is that because of the Supreme Court or just the politics that we're in today?
I think it's both. So Supreme Court in 2013 in a decision called Shelby County versus Holder invalidated the portions of the preclearance regime that I was referencing. Right. They found that Congress in reauthorizing Section 5 in 2006 didn't provide enough evidence to show that it was needed. They said that it was based on outdated information, like we no longer have literacy tests and poll taxes, yet the Voting Rights Act was reauthorized based on these outdated practices. And so, you know, that sort of set off a chain reaction, because after the Supreme Court invalidated that portion of the preclearance regime, it really was an invitation to many southern states to adopt more restrictive voting laws. And then our political situation is such where the polarization is so bad that this law, which used to enjoy wide bipartisan support, for example, the reauthorization in 2006 passed the Senate 98-0.
98-0. We should underscore that.
Yeah, 98-0. Yes, that would never happen today. The Freedom to Vote Act passed the House with zero Republican support a couple of days ago. So, I mean, just it's a reflection of the political time that we live in, where you can't get any bipartisan support for voting rights legislation.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Professor Fanita Tolson. She's Vice Dean at the University of Southern California Gould School of Law, Professor of Law. And I mentioned a forthcoming book is coming out next year titled In Congress We Trust? Enforcing Voting Rights from the Founding to the Jim Crow Era. And we asked her to join us today on Radio Times to put in context, the fight over voting rights legislation that is taking place in Congress in Washington, D.C. And you can join our conversation. In fact, we already have a couple of comments here. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about the right to vote today on Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Aim. We're talking about the ongoing fight over voting rights from the country's founding to today, from D.C. to the State House. And again, our guest in the first half of Radio Times today is Professor Fanita Tolson. Let me play a clip from earlier this week. This is President Biden speaking in Atlanta, Georgia on Tuesday about protecting the right to vote.
So I ask every elected official in America, how do you want to be remembered? At consequential moments in history, they present a choice. Do you want to be on the side of Dr. King or George Wallace? Do you want to be on the side of John Lewis or Bull Connor? Do you want to be on the side of Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis? This is the moment to decide, to defend our elections, to defend our democracy.
Fanita Tolson, your response to what the president was saying earlier this week.
I think he's right. I think that history will judge people accordingly, right? Because we are at a crossroads of sorts in our democracy. And part of it is the fallout from the 2020 election. It's like cognitive dissonance, right? We had historic turnout. North of 150 million people participated in that election. Yet a sizable portion of those individuals believe that the election was stolen. And so we are faced with a situation in which some states are tightening voting laws, despite the fact that there's no evidence that the election was stolen and that it was probably one of the most free and fair elections we've had in this country's history. And so because we're at this crossroads where we have to make a decision about who we want to be as a democracy, I think that, you know, this is a historical moment where the decisions that our elected officials make in supporting, for example, the Freedom to Vote Act, and the John Lewis Voting Rights Amendment Act, whether or not they support that legislation, I think, is given our historical moment and what's going on in our politics, history will judge them for that decision.
Well, and there's history and then there's the present tense, as you well know, Professor Tolson. But I'm thinking about, you know, the ability to target and get rid of poll taxes, which clearly were discriminatory, versus how you target disinformation and misinformation. That just seems so much harder in a way.
Oh, it is, for sure. And one of the reasons why it's hard is because a lot of it happens on social media, right? And social media in some ways is beyond the purview of the federal government to some extent, right? I don't know if the answer is, well, the federal government should step in and regulate Twitter and other platforms.
No, exactly.
Right. So I think it becomes very, very difficult to control what information is out there. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try. And it also doesn't mean that, you know, these private companies aren't taking steps towards trying to counter some of this misinformation. For example, Facebook, during the 2020 election, had a voter information center where voters could go to get the information that they needed to cast a ballot. Right. So it's not that we aren't seeing some movement on the you know, private corporation side as well. It's just that, you know, these are the challenges of our time. And the question is, are we going to rise to the occasion? And part of that means that we have to change the governing framework. This is not 1965 anymore, right? The Voting Rights Act of 1965 was perfect for the time, perfect for the challenges that the country faced at the time. So the question is, how do we deal with what's going on now? So, Marty, one thing that comes to mind is the fact that even when it comes to the governing legal regime, there are changes that need to be made that we haven't made. For example, most people don't realize that the Constitution doesn't contain an explicit right to vote, right? The right to vote exists because the Supreme Court in the 1966 opinion said that it exists in the Constitution. That is how they interpret the language. The problem is that, and one of the reasons why we have decisions like Shelby County, is that the Supreme Court can change that interpretation, right? They can decide to be more welcoming of state laws that are restrictive of the right to vote because they are the ones that inferred the right to vote out of the in the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And so they interpret the scope of that right to vote. So one thing we need is a constitutional amendment that guarantees the right to vote. That will go a long way towards according more protection to the right to vote and allow us to rise to the moment and meet the challenges of our time. But frankly, we don't have that either.
Well, I'll tell you what, I know we could talk on, and I know you have to leave us in a couple of minutes, and I do want to read a couple of comments from our listeners. Patricia says, one of the most vicious tactics I see is those who seek to restrict votes is that they use racially neutral language in their laws, but it's clear who they are targeting, African-American voters in particular, something, Professor Tolson, that you were talking about. But let me read a comment from Ronan. He says, can you explain the objection to voter ID requirements? Can you do that?
So let's start with the premise that every voter ID law is not the same. And so that's part of the reason why it's hard to have a conversation around voter ID law. Some voter ID laws are much more restrictive than others. And so some states only accept a very small universe of IDs that everybody do not have. So to use an example, Texas accepts military ID, which a number of people have, and they tend to skew Republican, but they don't accept school IDs. And so students who tend to skew Democratic have a very difficult time having an ID in that state. So just to give you a concrete example, but the problem with that conversation is that we assume all voter IDs are the same and they're not. And some voter ID laws, just by virtue of the types of ID that they accept, are designed to target certain demographics and make it easier for some demographics to vote and more difficult for others to vote. And then some were passed with the intent to discriminate. right? The intent, for example, to make it harder for Latinos to vote in Texas. So the voter ID conversation has to be more nuanced. And some voter ID laws are very permissive. For example, South Carolina has a reasonable impediment provision where you just sign an affidavit saying that you couldn't get an ID and they allow you to vote. So all voter ID laws are not the same, and some are more have a more disproportionate impact on communities of color than others.
We have a couple of guests who'll be talking more about what's happening with the voting rights acts that are in Congress right now. But I'm curious from your perspective, and it looks like, you know, their future is really under a cloud. Where we go from here?
Oh, Marty, that's
sorry to do that to you. I think we can interpret your exhale there, but go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that stresses me about all of this is that this is a conversation. These voting bills didn't just come out of anywhere. This is a conversation that's been occurring since 2018, when one of the earliest iterations of the Freedom to Vote Act was introduced as H.R. 1. And over that time, over the course of 3 years, Congress has held hearings, built a record, shown the need for this legislation, shown the need to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act with a new coverage formula. They have really sort of done the work here. And so I think that's my frustration, because mm-hmm. what you have is a piece of legislation that's tailored towards addressing some of the challenges that we have in our political system that might not pass because of a rule in the Senate that has no constitutional basis. And so, it's very frustrating, but the reality is that if nothing happens, we have a very small window here. The midterm elections are always a situation in which the party of the president loses seats. It is highly likely that the Democrats will lose control of Congress come November, right? So the window to do this is very, very short. So if it doesn't pass this year, it's likely not going to happen. Now, I know that Chuck Schumer was talking about a potential workaround where he takes a already existing bill and uses it as a shell for sort of the voting rights mega bill. So the Freedom to Vote Act and John R. Lewis Act together in order to get around the filibuster. I don't know if that's still on the table. I hope so, if they're not going to get rid of the filibuster, because I do believe that this is a moment where this has to get done or it will never happen.
Well, we will find out. And Professor Fernita Tolson, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. She is Vice Dean at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law, where she is a professor of law. Well, yesterday, Senator Kyrsten Sinema, Democrat from Arizona, went to the well of the Senate to declare her support for two voting rights bills and her opposition to altering the filibuster so they can pass without a supermajority of 60 votes.
And while I continue to support these bills, I will not support separate actions that worsen the underlying disease of division infecting our country. The debate over the Senate 60-vote threshold shines a light on our broader challenges. There's no need for me to restate my longstanding support for the 60-vote threshold to pass legislation. There's no need for me to restate its role protecting our country from wild reversals in federal policy. It is a view I've held during my years serving in both the U.S. House and the Senate, and it is the view I continue to hold.
She spoke just hours before President Biden's visit to Capitol Hill to rally Democrats around the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. Biden, who had opposed filibuster reform until recently, spoke earlier this week in Atlanta, Georgia, about the critical need for passing these bills. Yesterday, he conceded, quote, if we miss the first time, we can come back and try a second time. He apparently met last night with Senator Sinema and Manchin at the White House. Meanwhile, Republican-controlled legislatures are passing bills making it harder to vote. We began the show talking about the history of the battle over the right to vote. Now we focus on what is happening in D.C. and state capitals as the battle continues. And joining us is Nick Corasaniti, and he is politics reporter for the New York Times. Nick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is Claudia Grisales, and she is congressional reporter for NPR. And Claudia, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, to our listeners, we do want to hear from you. This is a ongoing story, certainly this week. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call 1-888-477-9499. Claudia, let me begin with you. Are these two voting rights bills, are they dead?
You know, you could possibly say they are close to dead. They have hit a lot of obstacles just getting to a point of trying to bring this legislation up on the Senate floor. As we saw, there was an attempt to try and at least start some debate on this in the coming days over the holiday weekend, and those plans fell apart. And now the plan is to take up these bills come Tuesday, but our expectation is largely that the votes are not there, especially without Republican opposition in the Senate, divided half and half between Democrats and Republicans. They need 60 votes to proceed. And so it seems that we are close to seeing the end of debate on these bills for now.
And Nick, is there, I mean, do Democrats have a workaround or do they want to hold this vote to put people on record, or how do you see, I guess, the politics of that? Nick? Oh, did we lose him? We lost him. Okay, sorry, we got some thumbs down through the wall here. Well, Claudia, let me go back to you then, which is, you know, is there a workaround for Democrats? And Schumer, you know, at least a day or two ago was saying we're going to have this vote.
Yeah, it's not looking very hopeful in terms of getting a workaround, if you will. There's the discussion about moving on to an effort to changing Senate rules so they can get past this 60-vote threshold that they need to surpass. And there's even less appetite for that as you played that sound for Senator Sinema very early on, before Biden even had a say on the Hill yesterday, saying, I'm not going to be a part of a change to these rules.
And I think we have Nick back. Do we have you back, Nick?
Yes. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's sure okay. That. No, it's live radio, and we just roll with the punches, so to speak. I said in my introduction that President Biden met with both Senators Sinema and Manchin last night. I know he has been meeting with them over the last couple of weeks, if not months. Do we know what they talk about, and what is his pitch to them?
So we haven't actually heard too much about, you know, what happened in their meeting last night. And, you know, the Washington Post had a pretty good inside the room recounting of how the Senate lunch went yesterday with President Biden. But his pitch has kind of been the same for months to them, which is that, you know, there's two crises that he's painting that need to be addressed. And the first is obviously a lot of attempts to make voting harder, add new restrictions to voting, the kind of thing he calls Jim Crow 2.0, and painting it as a real dire problem facing voters across the country, but particularly voters of color in battleground states like Georgia and Texas. But the second thing that I think has really animated the White House, and you saw this in his comments to reporters yesterday, is these different provisions that kind of mess with election administration, making it easier to overturn certain election results, take over county boards of elections, put more partisan control in what is normally a nonpartisan election administration operation. And it's led to a lot of fears about, you know, potential election subversion, especially after former President Trump tried to overturn the 2020 results. And that, I think, has really fired him up to a point of, like, existential dread when it comes to what some of these bills can do. Now, the flip side of that is that, you know, the Freedom to Vote Act has a few provisions about election subversion, but it certainly doesn't address all of the threats. But absent being in the room, we've kind of seen the president be somewhat consistent on this in terms of what he views as the threats. And I'm sure the press to those two senators is on that issue as well.
Well, and if I can go back to you, Claudia, just thinking about what is going to happen over the next couple of days. And it seems to both Sinema and Manchin, we're never going to budge on this issue about the filibuster. Do I have that right or wrong?
I think you have that right. I think they've been beating the same drum over and over, sending the message that they will not be part of any kind of movement to change the Senate rules. And they're making very forceful statements again and again as they're asked again and again if their position has changed. And they, again, say they will not be a part of it. Now, there's some discussion to tweak these Senate rules where perhaps there could be a talking filibuster where a member has to hold the floor by speaking. But in terms of changing that threshold and the ability to move bills forward, like large marquee legislation like voting rights bills, it doesn't seem like the appetite is there for these two members, regardless of what shifts we see for the rest of the party.
And Nick, the president has gotten some criticism for being late to this issue. Can you speak to that?
Could you repeat the question?
Oh, sure. I'm sorry for having some there've been some criticism that President Biden was sort of late to this particular issue about voting rights, and I wonder how serious that criticism has been.
It's been a frustration, I think, among voting rights groups and civil rights leaders pretty much since the Georgia law was passed, you know, in late March of last year. Because it was just so sweeping, and it took aim at so many different aspects of voting, such as drop boxes that were, you know, used so heavily in major cities, which were predominantly black cities, and counties like Fulton County seemed to make voting harder in those areas versus anything else. And so they were going to the White House with, you know, we need forceful pushback on this. This is going to make voting harder here. And some of the initial responses from some arms of the White House, now this wasn't the official policy by any means, but there were some meetings where there was a sense that, you know, these new laws could be out-organized around, right? Like, they had won a 2020 election against headwinds of a pandemic and an incumbent, and so these new laws, which would make voting harder, they could still figure out ways to work around. And I think that really angered a lot of voting rights advocates and civil rights leaders. And I think that's what led to the speech in Philadelphia. But then after that, again, the public comments from the president kind of receded as he focused on infrastructure and Build Back Better. And I think also anger these activist bases of the Democratic Party who saw, if the president called this the greatest threat to democracy since the Civil War, that it required continued repetition of that. And
I'll tell you what, you know what, we're going to take a very short break. We'll be right back. Hold on. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with our guest, Nick Corsaniti, national politics reporter for The New York Times, and Claudia Grisales, congressional reporter for NPR, about the ongoing fight over voting rights. We began by getting a historical perspective about the current fights today, and we are talking with them about the Voting Rights Act, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act in Washington, D.C., that looked like they are in trouble. Let me go back to you, Claudia. And I was even looking through the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And the Freedom to Vote Act included things like 2 weeks of early voting, 2 weeks of early voting, vote by mail and drop box, making Election Day a holiday, uniform standards for voter ID, and some other things as well. What's the objection? Do we know what the objection from the Republican Party is to any of the provisions in this bill?
Well, it's a very interesting argument when Republicans are asked about this. We just had Senator Mike Rounds on NPR earlier this week. This is the Republican for South Dakota. And he said he understands that there are concerns out there. For example, early voting. This seems like something that voters, he was asked, should have access to. And so what he said is that these issues need to be addressed at the state level, that at the federal level, that Congress essentially has no business to come in and try to regulate voting-related issues, that this needs to be left to the state. So he didn't point to so much as the issue itself of being able to access early voting, being able to do mail-in ballots, but he said that really that needs to be delegated to the states and not the federal level.
Well, let me turn to you, Nick. And there's a lot of action on the state level, especially states that are controlled by Republicans. What are you seeing?
Well, you know, over the past year, we saw, I think it was 34 laws in 19 states that add some restrictions to voting. And so those were battleground states like Georgia and Texas and Iowa, and then, you know, more red states like Arkansas and Kansas. And that is going to continue into 2022. We've seen pre-filed bills in Georgia where the top Republican in the Senate is looking to completely eliminate drop boxes. In New Hampshire, which is going to have a very competitive Senate race with Senator Maggie Hassan, they're looking to hand count every ballot, which could take weeks. And there's new pre-filed bills across the country still looking to relitigate the 2020 election, even though we're in 2022. So this push to reform our voting laws is not going away. It's going to continue in 2022 throughout all the legislative sessions, particularly as former President Trump remains fixated on voting and elections as one of his main topics that he's rallying the base around.
Well, let me just do a quick follow-up to that. Nick, when you look at states, blue states, you know, that have Democrats in control of legislatures, do you see sort of loosening of restrictions on voting?
To a degree. There's a common Republican criticism of states like New York and Delaware that, you know, they don't have early voting options in the same way that, say, Georgia does. And Governor Kemp, when he says that, is completely correct. And a lot of that is relics from old Democrat machines that, you know, were able to kind of weaponize voting rules to keep their politicians in power. And those haven't really been fixed. Even states that did expand early voting options, like New Jersey, which added, I think it added 8 days or 7 days. I'm not 100% sure there, but that's still not what Georgia offers. So there has been some changes in blue states, especially expansions of no excuse absentee voting and voting by mail. But it hasn't kind of fully been, I think, what you'd expect when you see what the arguments are at the national level. Certainly not every blue state has taken, you know, what their senators support in the Freedom to Vote Act and put it in place at the state level.
Let me go back to you, Claudia, and Nick referenced the January 6th committee that is looking into the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th a year ago. Nonetheless, in reaction to the results of the 2020 election and these allegations of voter fraud, how close are they to getting to some kind of either report or public hearings or some kind of conclusion based on their investigation?
Well, that's really interesting in terms of how close they are getting. They plan to push everything out this year, the January 6th committee, because they're facing a clock here. Republicans could take control of the House next year, and they want to make sure that they finish up their plans here because it's very much expected that the Republicans will shut down any kind of investigation at this level into January 6th. And so their plans are to present an interim report and then a final report along with hearings with their findings could happen as early as this spring into the summer months. And so they're also trying to beat the clock on the midterm elections as well. There's concerns about a political slant being given to the investigation. And so they're trying to stay away from that as much as possible. And so that's their hope that they will be able to push that forth. And there's a look at the Electoral Count Act and other legislative fixes they could address along the way.
And what's the Electoral Count Act?
So this is the law that many Democrats and some Republicans believe that former President Trump exploited. For example, the role of the vice president is seen as mostly ceremonial on the day that the election results are certified. However, they believe that Trump engineered a move to try and force Vice President Mike Pence at the time to try and move away from that ceremonial role and overturn the results of the election. Pence, of course, rejected that kind of a plan. However, that's what members are looking at now, is how do we strengthen this law so that we do not see anything like a January 6th ever again?
And that is Claudia Grisales, congressional reporter for NPR. Also with us is Nick Corasaniti, and he is a national politics reporter for The New York Times, getting us up to speed on what's frankly happening in Washington, D.C. related to voting rights and also some of the action at the State House level as well. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give give us a call. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Here's a tweet from a listener. And Nick, I'll put this to you. Our listener says, isn't the present attack on the legitimacy of votes in mostly black areas just a continuation of the KKK platform that people of color were not legitimate voters? Do you see it that way?
Well, the president certainly connects a lot of the new laws to a kind of horrid history of voter suppression in the South. There's the Section 5 states, the Voting Rights Act, put under preclearance that because they had such a horrible history of discrimination at the polls, anytime they wanted to change their voting laws, they had to get approval from the Justice Department before they could. And that was obviously hollowed out in 2013 in a Supreme Court case, Shelby versus Holder. So when you look at the impact of these laws, especially in Georgia and in Texas, they're going to be felt by communities of color in a kind of greater ratios to, say, other communities. And whether that is, you know, a kind of extension of long-held kind of voter suppression tactics against communities of color, you can see a continual thread throughout history, but the tactics are just so different now. It's much more surgical. You know, when you look at what was common in the 50s, there were, you know, these awful poll taxes or guess the butter beans in a jar before you're allowed to vote. And now it's more, okay, we saw mail-in voting, which was passed by Republicans in Georgia in 2005 as a way to kind of help their more rural voters get their ballots in, all of a sudden be used by a lot more urban areas using drop boxes. So now there's new laws to make that harder on them. You can kind of see a connection there, but I'm not sure you can totally, you know, connect the 50s to now in terms of the voting laws, just because everything's just so much different.
Well, and interestingly, in Pennsylvania as well, the no excuse mail-in balloting was approved by the Republican legislature in Harrisburg in Pennsylvania. And then, of course, it falls under this, the false allegations that it led to voter fraud. Here's a comment from Philip. The history of our path to a true democracy is really just a story of the expansion of the right to vote. A crucial next step must include election days being recognized as a national holiday. Claudia, I said that was, part of this, the Freedom to Vote Act. If that is uncertain, what's the future of election day as a national holiday? Does it have a future?
You know, that's hard to say. I mean, there's been talk in Congress if we can parse out pieces of any of these legislative proposals and pass them piecemeal, if you will. And so that remains to be seen if Democrats can get enough support for those kind of efforts. It's circling back to the mention of the Electoral Count Act. There have been Republicans who've expressed interest in looking at that, more protection for election workers. And so it's possible that this conversation could move on to these January 6th related reforms, legislative reforms that are being considered, and perhaps issues like that could get attached to the conversation there as well.
What do you think, Nick?
Yeah, I think that's kind of exactly where there could be common ground, is that Electoral Count Act. You know, and initially Democrats were even resistant because they thought it was being offered as, you know, we'll do this and that way there will be no longer any momentum for the Freedom to Vote Act, for the John Lewis Voting Rights Authorization Act. But now that, you know, the door is kind of shut on that, that might be the only option. And I think you might see a path forward for that in some way. I think Senator McConnell is actually a little concerned about the possibility of election subversion. He issued a very, you know, pretty emotional and angry speech after January 6th and used the role of the Senate and the power of the Senate in elections as key and important. And I think would be open to it being clarified. So that could be, you know, one path forward.
And Nick, do you think the filibuster, even beyond voting rights, but do you think the filibuster is just, it is here to stay? It is this, it seems like a roadblock to popular legislation. I mean, to get 60 votes, especially today, is just a hill that seems impossible to climb.
Well, I'd say that the filibuster's here to stay until it isn't. And I think when you look at the makeup of this Congress right now, which is, you know, so evenly split at 50-50, and with two Democratic senators who are clearly both institutionalists and then also pretty moderate. And also there have been some other senators like Senator Mark Kelly and John Tester who haven't necessarily embraced filibuster reform either. They just haven't been as vocal about their opposition as, say, Senator Sinema or Senator Manchin. But, you know, so for probably the rest of the session, it's going to stay. But who's to say, you know, if everything switches in 2024 and Republicans control all three and they're in a similar position where it's 50-50 and they want to pass a key voting bill or whatever the priority is, that we might not be in this same debate about a carve-out or eliminating it again. So I think it's tough to predict too much further, but for the 2022 legislative session, it sure seems like it's not going anywhere.
You agree with that, Claudia?
I think so. I think Nick's raising some really good points there and how the filibuster is here until it isn't. So it's just a tough path forward and what they're looking at in terms of any changes to this rule.
So what's next, Claudia, then for Congress? You cover Congress for NPR. But what's on the docket?
So once they get past this voting rights discussion, there is possibility here they could move on to issues such as more January 6th discussion, their findings there, legislative fix related to that, other ways to consider voting rights reforms. At the same time, we have a raging pandemic. There are so many issues this country is dealing with, so it's a possibility they'll be looking at supplemental funding to address this latest wave of cases for the new variant. And so a lot is on tap for the Congress coming forward in the coming weeks and months.
And Nick, as you look at state houses, are they dealing with their own version of what Claudia was just talking about?
Yeah, 100%. You know, I always think of state houses as 50 mini Congresses around the country, and they have their own dysfunction issues and their own way of passing bills on single party line. Like most of the voting bills were passed. I do think though that while maybe Congress might move on from voting once it looks, you know, inevitably like the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Act are going to fail, I don't think you'll see state legislatures, at least in battleground states where Republicans have complete control, move away from voting. Governor Kemp has signaled that he's not looking for necessarily an omnibus bill, but he would like a few more changes. But Governor Ron DeSantis, you know, he wants an election police task force that's going to be a law enforcement agency solely dedicated to elections. So I think we'll see it a lot more in the states. And then we're also going to start to see the impacts of the 2021 legislation because we're in a midterm year. You know, the Texas Tribune had a really good story last night that in some counties in Texas, absentee ballots are being rejected as high as 50%. And that's all due to the new law. So I think as those impacts become clearer, we also might see new action in state legislatures kind of in response to what's happening from the 2021 laws.
And Claudia, we're almost out of time. And I'm just curious, when it comes to public opinion, are these voting rights provisions, are they popular among the public, generally speaking?
Well, generally speaking, there is a segment of the population that has high interest in this issue, but at the same time, there are a lot of concerns out there in terms of what folks are dealing with, again, going back to the pandemic and other pressing issues, inflation, what have you. And so while these issues may have interest, they may not be priorities for some people right now.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Once again, Claudia Grisales, thanks so much.
Thank you much.
You're welcome. She's congressional reporter for NPR. Nick Corasaniti, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. National politics reporter for the New York Times. And we began with law professor Franita Tolson. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under programs. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.